Real-life biographical situations often inform the storytelling of novelists. And today, we feature two authors who have used experiences in their own lives to explore wider issues while entertaining readers through their novels. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Bruce Holbert's Lonesome Animals is a Western noir, which completely reinvents the Western and explores issues of violence, family, and the taming of the Wild West. I'll talk with him later in the broadcast. Lydia Crichton's Grains of Truth defies conventions of genre in this savvy, politically astute romantic thriller set in Egypt. Throughout the broadcast, we'll enjoy the music of Bahrainian composer Mohammed Haddad. So stay with us. It's A Novel Idea. The history and politics of the Middle East are in front of us every day, though perhaps we don't really get the complexities that contribute to the violence and distrust that mark our international relationships and that fuel global terrorism. Lydia Crichton's debut novel, Grains of Truth, manages to educate us, examine global realities, make political commentary, all in the package of a smart, sexy, romantic thriller. Crichton is a native Texan whose many trips to Egypt inspired Grains of Truth. And here is my conversation with Lydia Crichton. Your book, Grains of Truth, is set in Egypt, and it is a mystery, a suspense novel. But that is really a one-dimensional description of it. It evokes a richness about the geography and culture of Egypt. It also really does give somebody who might not fully comprehend the cultural, political history of Egypt or that area, really does, in a, I'm going to say, simple way to describe a complex situation, give the reader a sense of that. It also makes commentary on that through some of the characters. And it's a sexy, steamy story as well. So that's a lot to bring together into a novel. So we're going to break this apart a little bit at a time. And I want to say Egypt. It's obviously someplace you have some intimacy with. So why don't you talk about that a little bit?
I would be happy to. You know, your comments really make my heart glad because I had hoped to achieve a number of the things that you've just described. And it is a very complex subject, and that becomes more apparent each and every day by all of the things that are happening, not just in Egypt, but throughout the Middle East. I've just always really been fascinated by Egypt and the ancient Egyptians, most specifically. And on the first trip there that I made in 2002, I just was absolutely fascinated by the complexities of the old and the new, and how the new was so dependent upon the old and yet so very different from what the ancient Egyptians had been. And I just fell in love with the place, and I fell in love with the people. And I started educating myself about what their challenges were, and also about what my government, our government, what role we had played in where they were. And as I did that, and I wasn't totally new to Middle Eastern politics. My parents had lived in Iran and Saudi Arabia and Algeria. So I kept current on the things that were happening there. But as I delved back into history and our government's tendency, despite our democratic government, our support of authoritarian governments, I got kind of mad. And the more I read and the more I learned, I came to the conclusion that it just substantiated for me that although the American people, generally speaking, are isolationists in many ways, our government is very imperialistic and has been for a long time. And when I see what's happening there today, it really makes my heart sad. But I think it's important often that people take responsibility for themselves and for their choices. And when you look back at Egyptian history, I mean, it was ruled for centuries by foreign governments. And then when they finally overthrew the British, who were their protectorate at that time, and overthrew King Farouk, who was their puppet on the throne, they lived under authoritarian rule for decades, from Nasser to Anwar Sadat to Hosni Mubarak. It's the same group of people that had been running things for decades. And they'd done very little for the people. The government did very well for itself and received huge billions and billions of dollars in foreign aid from the American government. And I think most Americans were unaware of that. It's a very complex subject, but whenever you have these situations, across a big screen, the big screen of the world, it's always comprised of people, actors, and all of these actors play a role, even in, the lowest role, the day players. They're all important to the story. And that's how I like my history. I love historical fiction because it comes alive to me through the characters, because they're the ones who are actually making the history. So it was fun.
So you took this backdrop of Egypt and its situation and placed somebody there, our hero, our heroine,
Julia.
Julia Grant, and she is smart, astute, but at some times maybe a little hapless,
naive.
She's dropped into this situation really of international players and intrigue and the government. And so how did you decide to create this character and this woman? Is there a little bit of the author in her?
Well, there is. She's actually kind of a composite of a number of people. And, this is my first work of fiction and my debut novel. And I have been to Egypt several times and spent considerable amount of time there. And I did keep a journal. And when I came back, one of the experiences that I share with my protagonist is that I came back from my last trip with a life-threatening case of profound anemia. And it took a long time to identify the problem and to resolve it. And then it took a long time for me to recuperate from that. So I decided during that time it would be a really good opportunity for me to transpose my notes, so to speak. So this book actually started out as not a memoir in the sense that of something that I would ever intend to publish, but just so that I could clarify my own impressions and feelings. But of course, on all these trips, I met a lot of people there, and not just Egyptians, but players from across the globe. A lot of international people. I stayed in an apartment in Zamalek in Cairo, which is an island in the middle of the River Nile, where many of the embassies are. And I met Germans and Austrians and people from Hong Kong. And I just had an opportunity to talk to a lot of people. So as I began to write, I realized almost instantly that this could be so much better and so much more fun as fiction. And so Julia started taking on some of the experiences of the people that I met and stories that I heard. And yes, there is some of me in her. Julia is someone that I would like to know. You know, I'd like to be in her shoes from time to time. The other thing I think is really important, and that is, you know, being from San Francisco, you know, we pay attention to what's happening in the world for the most part. And when people today, when they're amazed and shocked and appalled at the revelations by Edward Snowden, I say, really? You're really surprised? Didn't you know what the Patriot Act was for? You know, that's why we protested it in San Francisco. That's why we marched up Market Street, is because we knew that this government was going to use that and misuse it to invade our privacy. And by golly, that's just what they did. And so I wanted to bring that into the story, and I thought that was the perfect vehicle to get Julia back on the scene in Egypt.
And I'll mention that Julia is an avowed pacifist.
Yes.
And that is a big part of her, who she is and her approach to life. And it affects every interaction she has. And so that was kind of heartwarming to see as a reader in a story where there is violence kind of
everywhere.
And she gets involved. The government kind of drags her into a plot. Do you want to take it from there that she is essentially recruited as an agent? And as you can imagine, if any one of us were recruited as agents, it might not go as smoothly as somebody might think.
Well, I don't think things tend to go smoothly in espionage. I mean, you know,
and there is, I will say, a lot of good kind of sidebar commentary from the Brits and everybody. It's, I mean, there's an international cast here, but of missions that go awry.
Well, and they do, and you know, I've just completed the third novel in this series, the sequence, and in the course of that, learned that in Washington, D.C., there is a facility called the International Spy Museum. And let's face it, people have been spying for a long time in every way that they could think of. And I've been an avid reader all my life. And one of my favorite authors of all time is John Le Carré, who wrote so extensively on the Cold War. And I just think he's brilliant and still writing to this day. I accidentally found one of his books in the library the other day, written over 50 years ago, that is as relevant today as it was the day he wrote it. But imagine, I mean, that's another thing I share with Julia. I also am a pacifist, but I'm also a realist. And I mean, I'm also liberated, you know. And so when a liberated pacifist goes to a country under authoritarian rule in a centuries-old patriarchal society, you come up against some pretty shocking situations, and it's a shock. And so you find, you know, sometimes you find your reactions surprise you. They kind of shock you, you know, even as a pacifist, when you see an injustice, you step up. Your hackles go up, and you want to fix it. And there may even be an inclination there that if violence is necessary to fix it, then maybe you would entertain that idea. And it's kind of scary.
And Julia faces that through the story, and we don't want to give the whole trajectory of the story away, but I want to come back to one of the reasons she was kind of targeted as a recruit and why she went back to Egypt so many times was her relationship with an Egyptian man,
Mohammed.
And this was brought in some of the cross-cultural kind of differences. And how does that translate into a relationship? And so that was part of what she's working out. And, you know, she must have also had a little bit of the femme fatale in her in a way, because it seems like men find her, no matter what their ilk, find her almost irresistible.
Well, you know, haven't we all known women like that? I mean, there's just something. I mean, let's face it, Jacqueline Kennedy. Oh, my gosh. Just the way she looked into a man's eyes when he was talking to her and the way she spoke, men were attracted to her. And she was very lovely woman, but she wasn't a beauty. She wasn't a great beauty. But there's just a certain kind of woman that men are attracted to. And I love watching that. When you see one, you know, it's really kind of one of nature's phenomena. And I think that Julia is probably one of those women.
So she, in one of her trips to Egypt, met Mohammed, and he is a Egyptologist working as a tour guide, and that's how they met. And she subsequently felt she had to follow that those feelings, and it brought her back to Egypt. And so, and he himself is a younger man, caught up maybe in the binds of his own culture that maybe prevented him from following his own passions in life.
Yes, and the strict rules of Islam, you know, prescribe a certain kind of behavior. And I thought it was very interesting this is something that I learned personally, that Muslim men are not supposed to dance with women other than their wives. And, you know, there are a reason for all of these things. And it doesn't have so much to do with the women as it does with the men. And this interesting, it was really interesting to me. Not too long ago, I was in a situation where I wore my hair up all the time. And one day I wore it down. And one of the men that I work with said, "You look so different with your hair down. You look so much better." And which was maybe not the most politically correct thing for him to say. But I said, "No, of course I do. Everyone does." I said, "That's why Muslim women have to cover their hair, so they won't be attractive to other men. The only men that are supposed to see their hair are their husbands." And it's a way for the men to control themselves and to control their urges. So you have these strict guidelines in this that make a lot of sense when you think about it. If you are in a society where men are not required to manage themselves, you know, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's up to the women to discourage their attention and their advances. And if they make them, it's really the woman's fault. It's not the man's fault. And then there's some things in patriarchal societies that are just maddening. And I found that more and more as I spent more time there. I spent a summer in Cairo, if you can imagine such a thing. And I just became increasingly frustrated with dealing with all of the, you know, elements of a patriarchal society.
You mentioned the dancing, and that is their first kind of steamy moment is through dancing. And it seems like there that maybe her first steamy moment with Alexander, who is another character who comes into this situation in dubious ways. But their first kind of intimacy was, again, through a lovely dance.
You know, when you think about touching, you know, we live in a society where pretty much anything goes with anybody all the time. And to be honest, I find myself kind of horrified by it because it just seems to me it's the other extreme. When you look at, you know, when you read, and I love to go back and read the classics. I just finished rereading Elizabeth Wharton's The Age of Innocence because it was another really just a beautiful, beautifully written book. And, you know, it was scandalous for a woman to show her ankle. Got a man so excited. Well, now, good grief. You know, what's left to get a man excited? And I have this mantra, actually. One of the things that drives me absolutely insane, my mantra is no cleavage on the news desk, please, ladies. You know, if you want to be taken seriously, you need to look serious. And but now it's so... So the dancing, you know, touching, just if in your society you don't touch and then you find yourself, you know, serendipitously in a situation where you are touching, it becomes very erotic.
I was just going to bring up the eroticism in your book, which is not graphic, but it is there. It's what I would call sexual tension. There's mm-hmm. sexual tension throughout the threads of story, and that's what I thought was very interesting, that the book had that. Isn't that what readers want, is a little bit of that sexual tension? There's the whole suspense and unfolding terrorist plots, and there's also this exposure to the culture and to blend all that together. And as the book progresses, there's this accelerated pacing that as it builds to its conclusion. So you were working hard.
Well, I'm really happy to hear you say that, you know, because this was my first book. I mean, I certainly did not work from an outline. It was a very organic process. And I did a lot of research. And a lot of times, some of the points that I wanted to make grew out of the research. It wasn't per se included in the book, but the characters were born from the point that I wanted to make. And who would best express this? Who could best tell this part of the story? And I probably edited this book from start to finish at least 24 times. It really was a labor of love. And because there was so much of my experiences in it, you know, I wanted to be really careful about not making it my story, but making it something bigger and making it something and showing the differing points of view, trying not to take sides.
And I think that was what was interesting, that you were able to have the characters reflecting on situations, and that allowed the reader to see the different points of view and have a little bit of background, because I think sometimes, especially with how things are presented to us in the news and the media, we have a very one-dimensional, skewed perspective of everything, and there's right and wrong, bad and
That's
good.
That's true.
And I loved the way some of the characters expressed, they reflected upon, that's what I'm going to say, they reflected upon the situations around them. And as the story progresses, Julia finds herself, she's in Egypt and she's trying to carry out a mission for the government, and more characters are introduced as the story progresses, kind of coming at this same situation from different angles and point of view. I mean, the archaeologists, then the Israelis get involved, and just like life. And so, as a reader, it's a page turner in that regard. I did want to talk to you about there was one particular passage where here Julia Grant, the main character, is I don't know how much I want to give away of the story, but she's in a burqa. She is not with her friends at the time, and she's in a precarious position. But she remembers being at the St. Catherine's Monastery and climbing Mount Sinai. And the description of that was just so evocative. I just wondered if that was an experience you've had.
It was.
And if you could talk about that.
It was. I did. And, you know, the truth is that I did some things when I was in Egypt that when I look back were probably not very smart. Because I was there by myself, and by myself most of the time. And so when I was in Cairo, I had this brilliant idea that I wanted to go to Sinai, and I wanted to explore Sinai, the Sinai Peninsula. So I hired a driver to take me across the top of the desert. So I wanted to climb Mount Sinai. And the way that they do that is that you go in a van with a group of people in the middle of the night because it's too hot to do during the day. So they take you to St. Catherine's Monastery, and you climb in the night. It's really, really dark. And you get to the top, and once you're there, there are a lot of the nomadic people, quote unquote, with their camels and their camel blankets. And you can rent a camel blanket that's never been washed and lie down and get a couple of hours sleep. And then you wake up to dawn at the top of Mount Sinai. And it was really an extraordinary experience. I did on the way down. It was broad daylight, and it looked a lot different. And I met some very nice people on the way down. And then you tour the monastery, and you visit the burning bush, which is no longer burning. It's time travel, is what it is. And you know, you're on the top of Mount Sinai, and you are standing next to Moses in the Bible. And it is when you look across the red, jagged mountains and see nothing but blue sky and clouds above it. I mean, it's extraordinary and very moving. And the monastery and the monks, they live in another century. So it was a very moving experience.
I can imagine that is the epicenter of much of religious heritage.
Oh, absolutely.
Is it a difficult climb?
You know, it was for me because although I didn't know it at the time, I had begun to experience anemia. And they do give you a flashlight. But as I said, there were other people there making the climb, but I was essentially by myself, and I was going really slow. And I was thinking to myself, you know, it's a good thing you did this now, because I mean, you're not that old, but you know, you might not be able to do this later. And I'm pretty fit, so I was a little surprised by that. But the other thing that I failed to mention is that night there was a meteor shower, and. Oh, my gosh. So I used that as an excuse, you know, every time I would climb 20 or 30 feet to sit down on a rock and look up at the sky and catch my breath.
Because that's a 4,000-foot elevation gain.
They've made it relatively easy, you know, because the path, you know, winds around the trail. You can rent a camel and ride a camel up if you want to do that. But, you know, it would never have occurred to me to do that because I didn't know that I could have died at any minute from a heart attack or stroke from profound anemia. You know, and later I subsequently, you know, realized, you know, I could have easily just passed over at,
behind a rock and, you know, been mummified in a couple of days. Nobody would have found me because
what a place to go.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's kind of the way I figured it. You know, you could do a lot worse.
But that was just one of many really profound experiences that I had there, which made me want to write a book.
I will encourage our readers to pick up Grains of Truth. It's the first in what I understand is a series of Julia Grant, maybe suspense novels. And where does Julia go next?
Well, you know, what I discovered, and again, this was all a very organic process. I didn't know this when I first started writing, but what I've discovered is that I am driven to write novels of suspense that are rooted in complex and controversial social and political issues, things that interest me, that I think are important, and that are unlikely to be resolved anytime soon. And what I hope to do is to entertain, first and foremost, but also to spark a little interest in the issue so that people come away from it wanting to know more. So my favorite part is without doubt doing the research, because I learned so much. And when I came back to California and came out to Napa, obviously illegal immigration is one of our country's most important issues today, and is something that we see before us every day in wine country. And so the second book is rooted in the illegal immigration issue. And again, you know, backtracks into some historical groundwork on our country's history with immigration. And again, our country's, our government's actions have not always been as honorable as we would like. And so it finds Julia in Napa and then in Mexico, once again taking on a role for her government and finding herself in some difficult situations.
So they liked her well enough to call her back.
Much to her husband's dismay. Uh-huh. And I'm not going to say any more than that.
Yes.
And then the third book, which is something, you know, that again was very personal to me, is rooted in the murky dealings of the American pharmaceutical industry and their Washington lobbies. And let me tell you, if writing Grains of Truth made me mad, this one will really hopefully open a lot of people's eyes about some of the things that are happening and have been happening in Washington for a long time. And the bottom line, all I can say is, you know, the first, what is that expression? What was that movie? Show me the money. It's all about the money. And that just really bothers Julia.
Very good. Very good. Well, thanks for coming in today, Lydia. And look forward to your books to come, and want to encourage people to pick up Grains of Truth.
Well, thank you so much, Suzanne. I really appreciate your having me.
You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. I'm Suzanne Lang, and you've just heard my conversation with Lydia Crichton. Let's take a short break and enjoy more of Mohammed Haddad's music. When we return, I'll talk with Bruce Holbert on his Western noir, Lonesome Animals.
Oh,
Bruce Hulbert grew up in eastern Washington State, the same country described in his novel, Lonesome Animals, where the Columbia River, harnessed now by a series of reservoirs and dams, dominates the landscape. Hulbert's great-grandfather, Arthur Strahl, was an Indian scout and among the first settlers of the Grand Coulee. The man was a bit of a legend until he murdered his own son-in-law, Hulbert's grandfather. It's a fictionalized Strahl that's the subject of Lonesome Animals. However, as a young man, Bruce himself killed a man, albeit accidentally, when the gun he was examining in the backseat of a car went off, killing his friend. Lonesome Animals is a Western novel reinvented and a detective story catered to the West. Russell Strahl, a tormented former lawman, is called out of retirement to hunt a serial killer who has been murdering and desecrating Native Americans. As the pursuit ensues, Strahl's own dark and violent history is revealed. Here's my conversation with Bruce Hulbert on Lonesome Animals. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me.
Lonesome Animals is a story, a Western. It is a mystery, but it is also a story of place, of storytelling, dealing with issues of life and death. I think it's a book for courageous readers. So I'd like to start first talking with you about the whole setting of the book, which is in Washington State, in a rugged part of the state, and in a time period that spans many years, but the bulk of the story happens during the period of time when the Grand Coulee Dam was being built. And I think this is a part of the country that you maybe grew up in. So tell us a little bit about that space and that time.
Well, I did grow up in that part of the country. I have lived here in different sorts of parts of the state for most of my life. I think I chose that time period because it was a time period when the West, the old mythical West, was still sort of present enough to collide with the new West, the West of controlling water and constructing dams and huge projects that weren't likely to occur in the West before that period. And I guess I'm interested in that collision. I'm interested in the Western myth and how it's dysfunctional in some ways. And a big part of the reason why it's dysfunctional is that it doesn't. It instructs people how to live in a different time period, and so choosing an instance where things were changing so quickly, the idea that a river like the Columbia River could be stopped up helped me sort of ground me as I was writing it in that, it made that change and that conflict just kind of constant.
And it seems that there were passages in the book where it went down to affecting really the lives and livelihood of people working the land. And
yeah, absolutely. It affects how people view themselves. You know, you tell yourself a story about who you are and how to be a man or how to be a woman, and all of a sudden the world changes so quickly that your story begins to have holes in it. It begins to not work so well. I think Strahl early on in the novel says that he's a mean guard dog with nothing to guard anymore because the place has settled down.
I'm glad you brought that up, and Russell Strahl is the main character in the book. He served as a lawman at one point in time, and then after a passage of so many years, he's called back into duty. I don't know if it's that same quote or if it was later on when he said something about being a a mean dog waiting for another dog, or something like that. And when I looked for that quote, I couldn't find it again, so I hope I didn't make it up. But
yeah, I think it's early on in the book, and I think it's I think maybe there were a couple of sentences related to that, to that idea of being a mean dog with nothing to guard. And what happens is the dog doesn't quit being mean.
Right. And yes, yes. And Strahl is an interesting character. And I looked at him as somebody who either didn't have a soul or was searching for his soul. I don't know how else to put it or characterize it. And again, it's some pretty tough experiences he has, he goes through, he commits, and very much dealing with life and death issues and issues of, or this is how I'm characterizing it, of humanity even, and what makes us human, and what is it to end a life. And I couldn't help feel that through some of these episodes, some of which are fairly grisly. And I know in your own life you have had that experience of that was characterized in a piece you had recently or a couple of months ago in the New York Times, that you yourself had the experience of accidentally shooting somebody and killing them. And I wondered if how that informed your portrayal of Strahl and his experiences.
Well, I suppose a big part of my conception of this book was my great-grandfather, whose last name was Strahl, but it's spelled differently. My great-grandfather murdered my grandfather. They were in an argument over land or something. My grandfather and my grandmother had come back to his ranch to help him out. He was getting older, and they had a disagreement about land, which isn't uncommon on ranches and farms like that. But it was always, you know, it always was one of the kind of family secrets in my family. I would ask my grandmother, where's Grandpa? And she, you know, all I knew was that he was dead. But the way people answered that question, even as a child, I knew there was more to it than that. And so as I got older, I pieced together more and more pieces. And then finally my dad told me more about it as, after my grandmother died. I think he felt like when my grandmother was alive, that it was, he was kind of honoring her wishes by not talking about it much. So I suppose that I was interested in, because I know that the death I was involved in was a tremendous influence on how I viewed the world and the rest of my life. And it really was an awful event to have been involved in and instigated. And I guess part of me was trying to figure out how my great-grandfather could have killed someone with intent and not feel or face the horror that, you know, that I felt like I faced. So I was really kind of poking around trying to figure out how somebody gets to that point. And I suppose if I compare it to my own sort of experience, it would be like the opposite. It would be like, how did he manage to kill his son-in-law on purpose, you know, when me accidentally shooting a friend tore me up as much as it did. So I suppose that's the influence that it had on my life. The other influence is obviously the sort of tradition of violence in the West that has interested me in a number of different levels for a long time.
And the whole collision as well of the Native American culture and the whites.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me that the Western myth and the Western experience has been one of self-annihilation, what happened was, you know, the mountain men came west because they couldn't stand, you know, civilization. And what they did was carve the roads out for the, you know, people going to Oregon and California. And it seems like every wave that came west was trying to create a place and escape from more civilized environs. And what they did was just make a really nice nest for civilization to take hold in. And the same people who destroyed the Native Americans, by destroying the Native Americans and destroying that idea, guaranteed their own destruction, because that was part of the idea that they had valued.
In your book, I noticed a lot of literary references and characterizations of lives as narrative. And I couldn't help but to think that you were maybe being somehow self-referential or reflexive about the writing process and the role of storytelling in general. I wonder if that rings true or not.
Less the writing process and more the idea of story and story's influence. And again, it goes back to this idea of a Western myth. You grow up in a story and you don't even, a lot of times you don't even know that it shaped you. But, you know, if you, at some point, if you can look at yourself with some objectivity, you say, geez, this is, you know, I've grown up and been molded by these ideas that people have been packing around for a long time. And that part of what I'm interested in with the Western story and with the idea of story in general is the sort of awareness that that it can lead people in strange directions, directions that maybe aren't intentional and aren't positive. Part of my thinking about the Western myth is that the Western myth is a story that was designed to teach people how to live in a world that didn't last very long. It passed away, but people are still living by the myth. If you live by that mythology right now, you know, right now it's a good way to end up in a penitentiary.
Yes, yes, because, well, it was brutal, and even even the law, or what purported to be the law, a lawman, was essentially making it up as he went along. What was seemed convenient at the time, even if it included killing somebody just because it was easier than hauling them back.
Yeah.
This book is told through a narrator. And the voice of that narrator is a strong one. There's a real pacing to the way the narrator tells the story that does get you somewhat in the head of Strahl, the main character. And I was as intrigued, I guess, with who was telling the story. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, about the narrator and why you chose that.
I suppose the narrator was me. I'm very interested in sound, the sound of voices and rhythms. I mean, I think if books are going to, you know, one of the aspects that makes a book different than other ways of telling stories is that, you know, the words make a sound in your head. And so I'm very interested in how words sound, how syntaxes are structured and things like that. And I suppose the sound of the words comes from a couple of people that, you know, I've been in my life. One's my dad. And, you know, there's a sort of truncated syntax that he uses that I think is fairly present in the book. And then another guy is a friend of mine named Lauren Carlin, who's a farmer that out in the Palouse country. And there's a sort of, in the way he talks, there's a sort of animation that I ended up enjoying listening to. So the sound of the voice is probably, you know, probably comes from those two sources, as well as, you know, just listening to other people. But, you know, the content of the voice is has to do with my interest in, I suppose, my interest in story. Many of the references that the characters make, or that I make as a narrator, has to do with, you know, how something is semi-biblical, or how it's, I think there's a reference to Teddy Roosevelt and his idea of the American West.
And Shakespeare.
Things like that. They're just things I've come across as you know, as I was considering. Part of what I have to do when I write, I'm not a very good planner. Plans seem to get in the way. And so I sort of turn myself loose and let stuff come in. And often that means that, you know, things that I'm thinking about will enter the story in different places.
Well, I enjoyed that voice, because it did have a very distinctive rhythm and pacing that created a unique world within the story. And there is a lot of grisliness and a lot of grisly descriptions of these murder scenes. And I think it's not for everyone. I know I had a hard time with some of them, yet I plowed through with my eyes closed. And is that something that you felt was, I don't know, driven by the narrative, that you needed to have that in there, or that it is
I always blame my editor, Dan Smetanka, because he kept saying, well, it needs to be more violent. It needs to be more violent. And I think he was right. And I think that the fact that the book is as grisly as it is serves what I was up to pretty well. One of the things about the traditional Western myth is that the violence in it is usually, it's redemptive, or there's some justice in it. And if I was going to call some of those things into question as I was writing, it seemed to me that I had to push the violence beyond that, that I had to push it towards the horrific, so that people wouldn't read it as we're in the habit of reading Westerns, which is, oh, well, you know, it's just the rough and tough American West. And so I think pushing the violence to that extent, making it not just, you know, not just awful, but strange, I think allows the book to revisit some of those ideas in the Western myth in a way that's not maybe as reductive or as familiar as I would have otherwise.
Well, Bruce, I want to thank you for spending the time with us today. And I just want to quickly mention, it seems like you have another book that you did with your wife. And maybe you just want to talk 1 minute about that.
Yeah, it's a book called Signed, Your Student. And it was actually my wife's idea. She wanted to work on something nonfiction, and I'm a school teacher. So at my school, we went through a pretty horrible thing. One of the students murdered his parents, and they came and arrested him at school. I mean, they had to, and it really shook all of us up. And you know, and my wife, upon seeing how affected we were, wanted to sort of write something that defied some societal assumptions about teachers, which are that they, you know, they don't care, or they're you know, part-time workers, things like that. And so she thought about contacting people, you know, well-known people, and seeing if they'd tell their stories about their favorite teachers. And she did, and we were shocked and very pleased by the response. There were a lot more people out there excited to honor their favorite teachers than we'd expected.
And what's the name of that book?
It's called Signed Your Student.
Signed Your Student. Well, Bruce, thanks so much for spending the time with us today, and I hope we get to meet and visit soon when you're down here in Northern California.
Yeah, I hope so, too. And thank you for having me, Suzanne.
My conversation with Bruce Holbert. I'm Suzanne Lang. Rosemary Manchester will be with us next month. We've featured the music of Mohammed Haddad, and we've had production assistance from Sean Knight. You can listen to us anytime at krcb.org, or you can subscribe to our podcast. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.